Državni izpitni center. Splošna matura 2020. Lepo pozdravljeni. Pričenja se reševanje izpitne pole slušnega razumevanja angleščine. Izpitna pola je sestavljena iz dveh delov, dela A in dela B. Vsak del vsebuje govorjeno izhodiščno besedilo in nalogo, ki se nanj nanaša. Najprej boste nalogo prebrali in jo nato med poslušanjem besedila sproti reševali. Vsako besedilo boste poslušali po dvakrat. Začetek in konec besedila bo označeval takle zvočni znak. Rešitve pišite z nalivnim peresom ali s kemičnim svinčnikom v izpitno polo v zato predvideni prostor znotraj okvirja. Pišite čitljivo in skladno s pravopisnimi pravili. Če se zmotite, napisano prečrtajte in rešitev zapišite na novo. Nečitljivi zapisi in nejasni popravki bodo ocenjeni z nič točkami. Zaupajte vase in v svoje zmožnosti. Želimo vam veliko uspeha. Poslušajte pozorno. Odprite izpitno polo.
Section A. You will hear an interview with Sir Michael Stratton, a British clinical scientist, about cancer research. You will hear the recording twice. Now read the task.
When Michael Stratton was a young doctor, he diagnosed cancer by studying tissue samples under a microscope. However, over the past 30 years, he's been advancing our understanding of this disease down at the level of the genes themselves, so that we're now able to read the DNA of a cancer, which has led to new diagnoses and treatments. Mike Stratton's first foray into genetics culminated in the discovery of the BRCA2, one of the main genes involved in hereditary breast cancer. Following this painstaking detective work, he and the Institute for Cancer Research became embroiled in a patent dispute with his collaborators. Mike is a scientist who, it's fair to say, enjoys a challenging project, and at the beginning of the 21st century, he set himself the hugely ambitious goal of identifying all the mutations in DNA that led to every type of cancer. His critics said it was a crazy idea, but Mike and his colleagues at the Sanger Centre, just outside Cambridge, have done it. Professor Sir Mike Stratton, welcome to the Life Scientific.
Thank you very much.
When you were starting out in medicine, did you ever imagine your research would lead to new treatments of cancer?
No, not at all. As I went into medicine in the first part of my medical training, I became interested actually in neuroscience. And then subsequently went into my clinical training and worked in order to sort of make myself into a practicing doctor. And I enjoyed working with patients, but I'd come at it from a very much a scientific bent. I'd known as a teenager I wanted to do science, and that's why I did medicine, because I thought this was a place in which I could use science to understand the nature of disease. Becoming a clinician, though, I encountered the organizational structures, I encountered hierarchies, I encountered bureaucracies, and this wasn't quite what I anticipated in applying science to medicine. And so I gravitated to a part of medicine where science was really part of your everyday life. Every day, looking down the microscope as a pathologist, you were looking at cells, normal and abnormal cells, cells that had become cancer.
Right.
And there I could see the science of disease unfolding in front of me.
So given this fascination, as you say, from childhood with science, why go into medicine in the first place? Why not do a degree in molecular biology, for example?
Well, I came from a first-generation immigrant family. My father was a Polish Jew who was a refugee after the Second World War, and my mother was Italian. And as many such families, the first port of call in thinking about a career for their children was in a vocation. And since I was scientifically and biologically scientifically inclined, they felt that maybe medicine would be a good thing for me, and I jumped at that. Medicine is an inspirational vocation, and so why not?
You studied medicine at Oxford, and then you returned to London to Guy's Hospital to do your, as you say, to do your clinical training on the wards. You were happy to be able to get back to the lab to study for your PhD. This was at Hammersmith Hospital.
So I did pathology at Hammersmith Hospital and learned what it was like to be a young scientist with all the moments of despair and moments of joy. And that's when I was looking down every day through the microscope, seeing cells with their blue nuclei, because the nuclei were stained blue because DNA is acidic and that attracts the blue dye.
That was the way of identifying.
That's the way of looking down the microscope and identifying cells and seeing whether cells are normal or whether the cells are cancerous. And at this time, as a young pathologist, it was actually a hugely exciting time in advances in our understanding scientifically of what cancer was. And in 1982, through the application of recombinant DNA technologies, an absolutely extraordinary advance was made in our understanding of cancer when the first gene and the mutation within that gene that could convert a normal cell into a cancer cell was found.
Now you will hear the recording again.
When Michael Stratton was a young doctor, he diagnosed cancer by studying tissue samples under a microscope. However, over the past 30 years, he's been advancing our understanding of this disease down at the level of the genes themselves, so that we're now able to read the DNA of a cancer, which has led to new diagnoses and treatments. Mike Stratton's first foray into genetics culminated in the discovery of the BRCA2, one of the main genes involved in hereditary breast cancer. Following this painstaking detective work, he and the Institute for Cancer Research became embroiled in a patent dispute with his collaborators. Mike is a scientist who, it's fair to say, enjoys a challenging project. And at the beginning of the 21st century, he set himself the hugely ambitious goal of identifying all the mutations in DNA that led to every type of cancer. His critics said it was a crazy idea, but Mike and his colleagues at the Sanger Centre, just outside Cambridge, have done it. Professor Sir Mike Stratton, welcome to The Life Scientific.
Thank you very much.
When you were starting out in medicine, did you ever imagine your research would lead to new treatments of cancer?
No, not at all. As I went into medicine in the first part of my medical training, I became interested actually in neuroscience. And then subsequently went into my clinical training and worked in order to sort of make myself into a practicing doctor. And I enjoyed working with patients, but I'd come at it from a very much a scientific bent. I'd known as a teenager I wanted to do science, and that's why I did medicine, because I thought this was a place in which I could use science to understand the nature of disease. Becoming a clinician, though, I encountered the organisational structures, I encountered hierarchies, I encountered bureaucracies, and this wasn't quite what I anticipated in applying science to medicine. And so I gravitated to a part of medicine where science was really part of your everyday life. Every day, looking down the microscope as a pathologist, you were looking at cells, normal and abnormal cells, cells that had become cancer.
Right.
And there I could see the science of disease unfolding in front of me.
So given this fascination, as you say, from childhood with science, why go into medicine in the first place? Why not do a degree in molecular biology, for example?
Well, I came from a first-generation immigrant family. My father was a Polish Jew who was a refugee after the Second World War, and my mother was Italian. And as many such families, the first port of call in thinking about a career for their children was in a vocation. And since I was scientifically and biologically scientifically inclined, they felt that maybe medicine would be a good thing for me, and I jumped at that. Medicine is an inspirational vocation, and so why not?
You studied medicine at Oxford, and then you returned to London to Guy's Hospital to do your, as you say, to do your clinical training on the wards. You were happy to be able to get back to the lab to study for your PhD. This was at Hammersmith Hospital.
So I did pathology at Hammersmith Hospital and learned what it was like to be a young scientist with all the moments of despair and moments of joy. And that's when I was looking down every day through the microscope, seeing cells with their blue nuclei, because the nuclei were stained blue because DNA is acidic and that attracts the blue dye.
That was the way of identifying.
That's the way of looking down a microscope and identifying cells and seeing whether cells are normal or whether the cells are cancerous. And at this time, as a young pathologist, it was actually a hugely exciting time in advances in our understanding scientifically of what cancer was. And in 1982, through the application of recombinant DNA technologies, an absolutely extraordinary advance was made in our understanding of cancer when the first gene and the mutation within that gene that could convert a normal cell into a cancer cell was found.
This is the end of Section A. Section B. You will hear an interview with Penny Farmer about her brother's disappearance in 1978. You will hear the recording twice. Now read the task.
Today, the dream holiday that ended in tragedy. In 1977, Peter Frampton and Chris Farmer had just finished university. After years of studying, they were excitedly looking forward to heading off into the world together. Their plan was to spend a year travelling through Australia and the Pacific Islands before heading to the Americas. Peter and Chris were in their early 20s when they set off, but their romance had started many years earlier, as Chris's sister, Penny Farmer, told me.
They met when they were about 14. We lived opposite to the Framptons. So they grew up together, very much in love. Chris turned down Cambridge in order to go to university with Peter. Chris studied medicine and Peter law. And their great ambition was always to travel around the world after they had graduated. But yeah, very popular people, had lots and lots of friends.
In December 1977, Peter and Chris's families gathered to see them off for the trip of a lifetime. This was before the internet, so they couldn't be sure when they'd next hear from the couple. But as it happened, they didn't have to wait long.
Just about every week we heard from them. Peter was an absolute consummate letter writer, very, very detailed letters to her mother. And Chris kept in touch by recording these tapes, cassette tapes, as they were in those days. And they were very colourful. He described the places that they were visiting, the politics, the food, the sights. You could get a real feel of their adventures.
So you got used to the idea that there would always be a letter or a tape coming.
Absolutely.
On a regular basis.
Yeah.
And through those letters, presumably, the family heard that they'd wound up in Belize, where they met an American man with a boat, a man called Silas Boston. Did they give a picture of this guy, Silas Boston?
Yes, incredibly, Peter, in her letter, told us his age, his full name, the fact that he was the skipper of this fishing boat, and that he was travelling with his two younger sons, ages 12 and 13, Russell and Vince Boston. She described the boat and their travels on the boat. They were on the boat for around 2 weeks.
Where were they going?
So Chris was a great sailor because as a family we all learnt to sail, and what he wanted to do was crew down the Belizean coastline. That they were great surfers as well. So this was a, you know, heaven sent opportunity to get some sailing experience in and, you know, to see that beautiful coastline. So they got on in Belize City and then they travelled down that coastline and they were going to Honduras.
Even though Chris and Peter were spending much of the time at sea, Peter still managed to send updates home whenever the boat docked. But in July 1978, no letter arrived. The families became worried, and I must warn you, you might find some of the details of Penny's story distressing.
Now you will hear the recording again.
Today, the dream holiday that ended in tragedy. In 1977, Peter Frampton and Chris Farmer had just finished university. After years of studying, they were excitedly looking forward to heading off into the world together. Their plan was to spend a year travelling through Australia and the Pacific Islands before heading to the Americas. Peter and Chris were in their early 20s when they set off, but their romance had started many years earlier, as Chris's sister, Penny Farmer, told me.
They met when they were about 14. We lived opposite to the Framptons. So they grew up together, very much in love. Chris turned down Cambridge in order to go to university with Peter. Chris studied medicine and Peter law. And their great ambition was always to travel around the world after they had finished, after they had graduated. But yeah, very popular people, had lots and lots of friends.
In December 1977, Peter and Chris's families gathered to see them off for the trip of a lifetime. This was before the internet, so they couldn't be sure when they'd next hear from the couple. But as it happened, they didn't have to wait long.
Just about every week we heard from them. Peter was an absolute consummate letter writer, very, very detailed letters to her mother. And Chris kept in touch by recording these tapes, cassette tapes, as they were in those days. And they were very colourful. He described the places that they were visiting, the politics, the food, the sights. You could get a real feel of their adventures.
So you got used to the idea that there would always be a letter or a tape coming.
Absolutely.
On a regular basis.
Yeah.
And through those letters, presumably, the family heard that they'd wound up in Belize, where they met an American man with a boat, a man called Silas Boston. Did they give a picture of this guy, Silas Boston?
Yes, incredibly, Peter, in her letter, told us his age, his full name, the fact that he was the skipper of this fishing boat, and that he was travelling with his two younger sons, ages 12 and 13, Russell and Vince Boston. She described the boat and their travels on the boat. They were on the boat for around 2 weeks.
Where were they going?
So Chris was a great sailor because as a family we all learnt to sail. And what he wanted to do was crew down the Belizean coastline. They were great surfers as well. So this was a, you know, heaven sent opportunity to get some sailing experience in and, you know, to see that beautiful coastline. So they got on in Belize City and then they travelled down that coastline and they were going to Honduras.
Even though Chris and Peter were spending much of the time at sea, Peter still managed to send updates home whenever the boat docked. But in July 1978, no letter arrived. The families became worried, and I must warn you, you might find some of the details of Penny's story distressing.
This is the end of Section B.
končuje se slušno preverjanje angleščine. Nehajte pisati, zaprite izpitno polo in jo položite na rob mize. Nasvidenje in srečno!